Hello, this week's episode, it's going to be a good one. We have Dr. Ramani on, who is a licensed clinical psychologist in LA, professor emerita of psychology at California State University, Los Angeles, and the founder and CEO of Luna Education Training and Consulting. She is an author of several books, including Should I Stay or Should I Go? Surviving a Relationship with a Narcissist, and Don't You Know Who I Am? How to Stay Sane in an Era of Narcissism, Entitlement, and Incivility. And her new book that just came out, It's Not You, Identifying and Healing from Narcissistic People. Dr. Ramani is the leading expert in today's world on narcissism and the impact of narcissism and high conflict, entitled antagonistic personality styles on human relationships, mental health, and societal expectations. Her work has been featured on SXSW, TEDx, Red Table Talk, The Today Show, and so much more. You can also find her on YouTube, where she has accumulated millions of views on her videos discussing narcissism on her successful channel and on social media at Dr. Ramani. I'm super honored to have her on, and she has a podcast, Navigating Narcissism with Dr. Ramani. Go check it out. And to find out more about how narcissism can impact on relationships, let's get right into it. And now, a word from our sponsors, BetterHelp. This week's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. In a world where we are bombarded with things all around us, we sometimes forget to do things with our life, our extra time, the small moments. And it's sometimes very hard to feel like we're being productive. And I'll tell you, therapy can help find production in life, help guide, help have someone listen, and help have someone truly hear you with the needs that you're looking for to get out of the hectic lifestyle that we all have. I know for myself that I've used therapy for years to help me keep balanced, calm, and a set of tools that help me individually. Because when it comes down to it, we all need that extra help. We all need someone in our corner. And if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. Because it doesn't hurt to just try once. And if you love it, you stick with it. And if you don't, at least you tried to pick yourself to find what you need with convenient, flexible therapy model, BetterHelp. So learn to make that time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/dudetherapist today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/dudetherapist. Don't wait to find the help that you need. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Dude Therapist. We have Dr. Ramani on. And, in the world today, and we're going to get to this later, there are certain terminologies that have come into like everyday life that, as a relationship specialist myself, hear a little too often in the wrong ways and not the ways that it actually means, which can do so much more damage for society, ourselves, and relationships. And we'll get into that afterwards. But if you can introduce yourself for the listeners, if they don't know who they are, who you are, they should, and start listening, because she's one of the best in the business. So thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Eli. My name is Dr. Ramani Dervasala. People know me as Dr. Ramani. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist. I'm a professor emerita at Cal State LA, where I was a professor, active professor for 22 years, where I did research and as well as teaching. I'm an author. My fourth book is coming out, also about narcissism and healing from narcissistic relationships. I have a popular YouTube channel that's focused on these relationships, a podcast, Navigating Narcissism, and run other programs for people who are healing from narcissistic relationships. So that's me.
I ask this a lot to like the professionals who have a very niched avenue of their work. Why this out of all things when it comes to relationships?
Yeah, I mean, the niche grows over time, right? I don't know that anyone can ever start with a niche. I think we evolve into niches, as it were. And so I, way back at the beginning of my academic career, I got really interested in antagonistic personalities and how that impaired engagement in healthcare, and particularly how it affected healthcare professionals, and really got interested in personality styles like narcissism and other similar personality styles. And I was working a lot in the area of HIV at the time, and sort of how those personalities show up with substance use and sexual risk behaviors and all of that. At the same time, I also had a private practice, and I was seeing more and more clients talking about the same kind of marriage. You have a client, and they're, I mean, we're in an interesting era. They can bring in emails and text messages and play voicemails. There's no doubt. This is not just a person saying, oh, this is what I think. They're showing me in writing. I'm like, okay, this is unmistakable. And then what was very striking to me was, you know, obviously because of my own research and then doing the clinical work, I'm researching this. I'm like, okay, so much written about narcissism, so much written about what we used to call cluster B, nothing written about what this does to the person in the relationship. Nothing, as though they don't exist. Like, these people are wreaking havoc, but we weren't going to talk about the people who are being havoced. And I thought, this seems really a problem to me. And that's how I got into this area. I myself have lived experience. I have experienced it in my family. I've experienced it in intimate relationships. I've experienced it in friendships, in the workplace. And it changed the course of my life. And it changes the courses of lives of people who are in it. And it intersects with sociological issues like privilege and power in society and all that. So I really do think it's the issue of our time. We have incentivized something unhealthy. And, you know, and these chickens are coming home to roost in the form of really damaged mental health for people who are in these relationships.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we talk about the idea of narcissism or toxicity or and we'll get into the, you know, the classic terminologies of gaslighting and all those kind of things later. Is there research behind how it is created or starts in someone? Is it because of other factors, or does someone learn that, or are they born into that way in nature nurture kind of understanding of it?
So personality is a byproduct of social and emotional development. There's no two ways about it. A person's born with a temperament. Certainly there's a biological element to personality, but then that enters into the environment, right? And then it's shaped at that point by the environment. Mm-hmm. One could argue that there are sort of two pathways to narcissism. The challenge with these pathways is the vast majority of people who grew up in these pathways don't become narcissistic. But the two primary pathways we see is the pathway of adversity, trauma, chaos, invalidation, abuse, again, adversity all around. That can certainly shape narcissistic personalities, particularly more of a vulnerable style or even a malignant style. And on the other side, we have sort of the overindulged, overvalued, you're so special, you don't have to regulate, you can do anything you want child, who often have parents who are very materially indulgent and tell their kids you're amazing all the time and post about them on social media, but they're actually not very emotionally present. Those folks can also go on to become narcissistic. We can see more of sort of a grandiose style that would probably emerge there. But again, the vast majority of folks raised in those two tracks don't become narcissistic. So it is some sort of intersection of temperament, clearly of environment, of other sociological shaping factors. And then you put that all in a blender and out comes a narcissistic person.
Mm-hmm. So like, is it a protective factor? Is it a protection for the person who is behaving that way?
Well, it is, because they're grandiose defenses, right? So if we look back at the earliest writings on narcissism, it really is the psychoanalysts and the object relations folks who took it on. No other real theoretical school has ever taken on narcissism in a meaningful way. But I mean, we see it in psychological writings, probably going back to the late 1800s, folks like Havelock Ellis and then Otto Rank and Freud. They talked about it really very much as a defense. And it's a defense against a deep unprocessed shame. It's a defense against a deep, unworked through insecurity, and the sense that if the fault of the person were to be publicly witnessed, that it would destroy and engulf the person. So the grandiose defenses then act as a protection. When we view it that way, we really do want to be compassionate to someone who is having the struggle. The problem is they're not attempting to address it. There's no making amends. There's no self-awareness. How long can somebody be put into the position of being a punching bag for somebody working through their insecurity?
Yeah, to give them that, like, that grace or compassion, like, oh, they're just working through something, but they're getting beaten down.
They're not
time,
working
right?
it through, though. They're not going to therapy. So they're not doing anything. They're just living their lives and they're a human wrecking crew.
Do people who kind of struggle with that grandiosity, do they think more often than not that they're fine? Like, I'm good. This is just how I am. I don't need to go to therapy and work through things, or I don't have to work on stuff.
Not only do they think they're fine, they think they're better than fine. They think they're more empathic than everyone else. They think they're the best folks around. If anything, if they don't get that regard, they feel deeply misunderstood. It's a witch hunt. Everyone's out to get me. Nobody sees how wonderful I am. So it's actually a real distortion in evaluation of self and appraisal of self. But they actually think that they're good people and they'll do generous things. They'll get people gifts or donate lots of money and say, look at me, I'm a saint, but then they'll behave horrifically interpersonally. Mm-hmm. They often view their good deeds as erasers, and it doesn't work that way.
Yeah. And like, I know this is a common thing that people struggle with, of like, everyone has selfish tendencies and self-centeredness at some points of me versus you. Where's the line of like a healthy amount of self-advocacy or self-focus comparatively to, I don't care about you at all, and that narcissistic tendency?
That's the distinction, though. The self-focus tempered with self-awareness and awareness of other. So if a person says, hey, I'm about to go lock in for 12 hours to do something that I need to do, but they've made arrangements. They've ensured that whatever responsibilities they have to other people have been addressed, whether they're caregiving or otherwise. There's an awareness of this impact. They check in with people before they do it, or they construct their social world in a way where there isn't that sort of dependence being focused. If a person wants to play golf and tennis every weekend and live a grand life, you may not want to get married and have kids. And so it's the idea that it's all about me without any recognition of the other. I hear where you're going is that I absolutely think healthy self-advocacy is crucial to a sense of self, but that needs to be tempered and informed by empathy and awareness of others. That's the balancing act. And I think that when people have that self-awareness, then that's the game changer, and can communicate about it and talk with partners or loved ones or colleagues. That's the piece. And then it doesn't even feel like selfish anymore, though a person may acknowledge that, I'm definitely focused on my own thing for a minute. But again, they would have communicated about that and touched base.
You know, and I work with couples every day. I work with like at least 2 to 4 couples a day. It's like my specialty. It's what I love, working in relationships. And I work with people often of the idea of asking for me time, the individual time within the relationship, not being something that's narcissistic or selfish, as long as you communicate, hey, you got your time. I have my time. You watch the kids now. I'll watch the kids later. This give and take, this care for others as well as self. That's called balance. That's called healthiness, right? And yes, there are some people that struggle with that guilt piece, whether it's mom guilt or dad guilt. To me, when you have that guilt of concern, that's a good thing. Like, not that it's not healthy how much it might consume you from stopping you from being present, but it means you care about other people enough.
Yep. I totally agree. And so it's finding a way to almost use a different word than guilt, right? Because guilt implies you've done something wrong.
Yeah.
And then to understand the deeper messages of what was communicated to someone. Because when I hear guilt, when somebody says, I want to spend some time on myself, I'll often want to keep digging in to their early developmental stuff. Were they shamed about expressing needs or wants as a child at all? And they, or, you know, what sort of duty-bound obligations were they told about culturally or all of that? But all of that, that, you know, said, what you're talking about, that idea of achieving equitability in time, it's not possible for a person in a relationship with a narcissistic person. There's just no getting there.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I'm glad you add that piece. You know, I want to kind of switch over to like the hot topic of our this time, is like the gaslighting mentality. Can you kind of talk about what that actually means in theory as well as practicality? And then we'll dive into some of the questions.
Yeah. So gaslighting is a process. We can call it a tactic, but it's a process whereby one person, the gaslighter, denies the reality of or perception or experience or memories of another person outright. And then they double down behind that and tell the person there's also something wrong with them. So it would be an example of that is, I never said that, when in fact they did. I never said that. And you know what? I think you're paranoid. I actually think there's something wrong with you. You may need to go get some help. Gaslighting is designed to destabilize the other person because it's not just about lying. It's not about, it's not epistemic, as it were. It's not about evidence or knowledge. It's really about, I'm going to control and dominate you, and it's going to be my version of reality. There's no other version. And so over time, gaslighting is not a one-off. It's an indoctrination process. It happens over and over and over and over again, where over time, the gaslighted person is almost has completely capitulated because that's the only way the relationship can work. But people would say, why doesn't a person just get out if they're being gaslighted? Because these are relationships, foundationally, gaslighting only really works if there's some element of trust, love, connection, in some cases, expertise. Mm-hmm. So there's a belief in that person and there's an investment in that relationship, which is why gaslighting is most profound in intimate relationships and in family relationships, because there's an investment in keeping that relationship going. And most people out of hand don't want to say about someone they love, oh, they're a manipulative gaslighter. Most of us in the striving for attachment are willing to sort of hold the plausibility of, maybe I didn't remember that right, or maybe I didn't put the remote there. And we take in that self-blame and self-doubt one time, fine, 100 times, 200 times. And you internalize the sense that I'm a disorganized, lame person. I'm not that smart. I might actually have memory problems. There's something wrong with me. So it is a core dynamic of the narcissistic relationship, because the motivator of the narcissistic person is not intimacy and closeness, it's power, domination, and control. And gaslighting is the fastest way to get it.
Yeah. And also for people who might say, oh, how come you can't get out of it? It didn't happen where you were just like put in a prison one day you couldn't get out. It's a gradual thing of experience of someone that you love and trust, of conversations, arguments that you might chalk up to, oh, well, every couple gets into an argument or you know, everyone disagrees and differs. You know, okay, fine, this happens. And then the next time, by the time you're actually totally kind of pulled away from that reality, it's not just today to tomorrow. It takes time to create that environment for someone. So people are saying, oh, why can't you just get out? It's so easy. Mm. They're not always aware of it because it's happening in small doses of normal within the structure or maybe facade of normalcy within a relationship. So, you know, within that, where is the difference of differing in opinions and argument and saying, here's my perception, here's your perception? Is the distinction between gaslighting and argument or conflict within a relationship just, I see your side and you see my side and we just have different opinions versus denying someone else's side?
Yeah, it's not only denying someone else's side, it's completely defaming someone else's side. Mm-hmm. So it's not simply, I not only don't agree with you, you're patently wrong and you're an idiot.
And here's why.
That's gaslighting, right? And it's not even the here's why. It's like no one smart believes that. Like you're the dumbest person I've ever met to believe that, because what you believe is wrong. And in fact, it's an opinion. So in a healthy relationship, there's a phenomenon called intersubjectivity, the capacity of being to be able to hold space for two different senses of reality. One person's hungry, one person's not. One person's warm, one person's cold, yet they're in the same room. So intersubjectivity is very much based on empathy. It's the capacity to recognize someone's having a different experience from me. Someone is separate from me, and I don't need to convert them into my version of things, right? Mm. Narcissistic relationships lack intersubjectivity, right? Mm-hmm. So you go to the analytic work, Jessica Benjamin, folks like that. That's where that writing and folks like Dan Shaw have now taken it to understand the narcissistic relationship. And so when we look at that, that is gone. And in the absence of intersubjectivity, someone can't hold space for your reality. So it's like, no, I have an opinion and it's fact. Opinion transfers to fact in the hands of the gaslighter, but it's the double hit. Your opinion's wrong and you're dumb for even believing that. Mm-hmm. And that's when it becomes a gaslight.
And I know I said we're not talking about politics and we're not going to talk about politics in like the specifics, but we see that very often nowadays on social media with political conversations. Mm-hmm. Of you're an idiot, you're stupid.
Yes.
You're a dumb so-and-so, whatever, whatever, because you believe that. Correct. That's insane. You need to go to a mental hospital. You know, you're ridiculous. That's right. or you're crazy, right? We use these terminologies about someone having an opinion about either a president, a political movement, something happening in another world, whatever it might be in today's day and age. It's the dump on the other person till they feel like so small and nothing that they don't have anything to say back or they don't know how to respond. And it kind of puts them in a place of
So to your
submissiveness.
Right. So what I want to push back though on there, Eli, is that in social media, it gets interesting, right? That is gaslighting, but it's operating in a different way. If that person's a stranger, it's still going to be upsetting, right?
Yeah.
To have someone call you all those names, but it doesn't have the profundity and the power of someone you love, because with that, you can block that person. They're a stranger to you, right? You know, like, okay, I don't care. This person has different views to me. Fine, done. But when this is someone you love, you care about, you have a history with, and they're coming at you, even in that difference of opinion, in that argument, it's an entirely different experience. And there's no capacity for an argument in a relationship where gaslighting is present. There is no such thing. It's really it ends up becoming a domination, not an argument. And that's a different experience. So what happens is the gaslighted person, the receiver of the gaslighting, will often shut down to keep the relationship going.
Yeah. And they'll kind of be like submissive and okay, yeah, you're right. Of, oh yeah, yeah, I see how that could be true. Oh yeah, I'm sorry. That was my mistake. And kind of start being very, okay. So to me, there's two things then that I think I'm thinking of that can really impact someone's general relationship structure, trust of someone else and trust of self, right? So how does someone rebuild that? Because I've worked with a few clients that I'm working with as we speak, where things, and in the past, you know, 8 years of doing this, that there's trust issues that occur when they feel someone has been dismissing them, putting them down, whatever words you'd like to use for that. How do you create, not just, how do you work on trust of self to believe yourself again? And how do you start believing in someone else at the same time? How do you work on both?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's part of what healing from narcissistic relationships is about, is that simultaneous building of trust in self and trust in other. Trust in self, though, is the first stop at the depot. Trust in others is not even going to be able to happen until there's trust in self. And I bring it down to bare bones with clients. I mean, it's almost like it's literally push notifications on a phone that say, that touch base with them. Like, how am I feeling right now? Am I cold? Am I warm? You know, do I like this show? It's literally how they're responding to environmental cues, because even that got lost in these sorts of relationships. It's really that kind of reflective, like, how am I doing right now? And meaning, and that could be done through journaling. Like I said, it could be done through push notifications, but multiple times per day, touching base with themselves. And, you know, and even doing that alongside a therapist or anyone else, is that to just kind of force themselves into giving themselves the opportunity to talk about their subjective reality. That's a big part of the trusting of self. And, you know, another is, you know, I tell clients that you don't need to move any faster than you want to, right? So there's a tentativeness. And so, but it can't just be you do something, whatever it is, whatever you're doing in your day, everything to be reflected on. Hey, you just did the grocery run. How'd you do with that? No, it's fine. I drove, I parked, I got the groceries, I got in my car. Did you forget anything? Actually, no. I think I probably bought more of this than I needed. But as strange as it sounds, it's this, okay, so you're building the sense of agency. I can do things. And that happens alongside this sense of trust. I have to say, because I work with so many clients recovering from these relationships, we do a lot of work around new interactions, right? So they'll meet someone new. Might not even be dating. It might be someone new in a job. They go on an interview. They go to a meeting. They meet a new friend, whatever it may be. And they will bring their impressions. They'll say, it's a little weird. Like, I kind of got this weird vibe from them. And I don't want to be that bad person who judges people, but it didn't feel comfortable. Right. And instead of saying, well, give them a chance, therapy becomes a place of, let's sit with that feeling. First of all, where'd you feel it in your body? And they'll often really connect to, you know, it's funny, it's very similar to this kind of the stuck in the throat, the feeling in the gut. There's something I felt that feels familiar and it made me cautious. Okay. So let's run with cautious. And they'll say, you know, I can't put a word to it, but it didn't feel right. I think the person's interesting, but maybe I'll meet them again, but I don't know. And then the second time, they might get more confirmatory evidence and say, I was right. And that's the moment. And in some ways you have to wait for life to give the experience where they can test these discernment abilities, because that's what this is about. It's discernment. And discernment starts with, what do I want on my pizza? What temperature do I want the thermostat at? And then you keep working up from there. We're starting from zero and we're working our way up in terms of building trust in the self. But again, everyone needs a validating voice. As a therapist, we get to be that. And it's crucial therapists be that, instead of, we're not coaches. We're not like, no, 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 go meet new people. Hell no. It's sit with that and say, let's talk about how this felt. And then continue. And they might have to find that in friends. Friends will say, who will validate their experience. Like, if it didn't feel good, then it didn't feel good. And that's okay. Slow down. Because that's what a lot of folks were not able to do when they were in narcissistic relationships, is all intuition is crushed. You're trying to actually connect them back to that. The best way I find that to do is have them connect somatically, because people feel it before they think it.
Yeah. You know, I remember when I was training to be a therapist, and one of my favorite supervisors, I always talk about him, Dr. Stanley Rustin, was an old school kind of person. And he's talked about, when you work with someone who either has a borderline personality disorder or narcissistic tendencies, or even disorder, you can feel it in your chest and your stomach.
100%.
So he said, as a therapist, when you start getting that stomach ickiness or that chest tightness, and you feel uncomfortable, that says something about, you know, you have to pay attention to yourself as a therapist and feel that. It doesn't mean you stop working with them. It doesn't mean that you go, get out of my office, but listen to yourself.
Correct.
Don't go, hey, push that out of the way. Let me ignore that. It doesn't mean you stop the work. It means you pay attention to it and lock into that and try to understand that later in supervision, or as you get older as a therapist yourself in your own processing. So I love that. My question is, you know, that's really all wonderful. And I love that perspective of starting from scratch and really digging deep. That sounds so tiring to then, right, to fight for, do I like pineapple on my pizza or pepperoni? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, to me, the critical lens, and I want to hear your perspective, because you're the expert on this from so many reasons and avenues of why you're so good at this. You go about your day, you're testing. Oh, do I like this? If something that the old relationship liked and you still like it, that's okay, because you have done the work to analyze it and go, no, I like it too. So don't be afraid if you happen to end up liking something that the other person had liked convinced you to like, or whatever reason. If you actually like it again, that's okay. Mm-hmm. So what about the trigger happiness of the trigger happy of the worry? When you're in a relationship again, you've done the work, you get to the place where you're comfortable enough to get back into the game of relationships, and you go, oh, I don't like this. Oh, I don't like this. Like, and is there something to work on the idea of being triggered of trust issues quicker than because you're sensitive and hyper-focused based on your past relationship?
Couple of things. You got to give yourself time. You know, I write in my new book about this idea of a 12-month cleanse or a 12-month detox. I tell people, if you're coming out of a relationship that felt narcissistic, manipulative, gaslighting, call it what you will, give yourself a year. And people say, are you kidding me? Like, I'm lonely. I've been lonely for years in this. And I'll say that it takes a year to reacquaint with yourself, body, mind, emotion, all of it. It's going to take that long to figure out everything from pizza toppings to feelings to discernment, to get past the grief of anniversary dates, to navigate the territory of a year. Year's a long time, and a lot of good work can be done in a person. How do you like to fall asleep? Well, how do you like to travel? All those things that completely went out the window. With that year under your belt, you might be a little less prone to the overcorrection. Well, I'm not watching football because he liked football and there's no way. Versus you might, the football may not be as strong a trigger. Time may have helped that, as well as working on individuation. The analogy I work with clients is one of an archaeological excavation. And I say an archaeological excavation is not it's not like a scoop loader bulldozer thing coming into a ditch. It is people with tiny little shovels, and they're taking those tiny little brushes and trying to get tiny little shards. And that's what you're doing with yourself. This is not a big, like, dig it in. This is like shovels and brushes and gentle. And they're like, oh, this is something I've learned about myself. And this is something I am actually more introverted than I thought, or this actually matters to me more than I thought. That takes a year. And that a year is me being nice, because most people are like, girl, I'm not doing more than a year. And then after that time on you, you might be in therapy, you might travel, you might take a break from work, whatever the person has a luxury of doing, right? You may simply just dig down into yourself or your children or whatever. When you get to the other end of that year, you're in a far better position to be discerning. I tell folks all the time, people who've really been through it in narcissistic relationships will regularly throw back fish that were big enough to keep. And I'm like, that's okay. That is okay. You know, because it's a, they may overcorrect, which is what people do. And then with those overcorrections, and if there's safe places for people to talk that through, they'll start saying, okay, I see what I'm reacting to. It's a puzzle. It's a process. None of this discernment was ever brought to dating earlier. We don't teach people discernment in dating. We teach people checklist dating. We now teach people how to date in a way that looks good on Instagram. We don't teach discernment. People are fussy about wine and olive oil, but they're not nearly fussy enough about the people they let into their lives.
We dive into that for a second. What are some of the skills that we would like people, what does that mean? Because I understand the checklist concept of, do they have these personality characteristics, family, whatever, money,
right. Job,
all that kind of stuff. And I love the Instagram success looking type of thing as well, which is a problem that I have with a lot of people, the look versus the actuality of the relationship. Yeah. What is the discernment skills different than the checklist? Like, are we talking the stupidity of red flags, green flags, beige flags, which people get too into that a little bit too much. Okay. Just like gaslighting, they use it like, oh, red flag, like what's your ick, right? When it's, they zip their, you know, pants weird or whatever it is, or so what's the difference? What's actual discernment skills?
All right. So, so again, you know, somebody once asked me, they had me on like a gamey, like a game. They were playing a game with me on a show of some kind. And they said, somebody orders chicken nuggets on a first date, stay with them or break up with them. I'm like, this is not even relevant. Like what? I mean,
do you
like chicken nuggets? Who cares? Exactly.
Chicken nuggets are awesome.
But I happen as somebody who's raised kids. I've eaten a lot in my time. I'm fine. But how quick people were to say, that's not okay. Chicken nugget on the first date, right? So it's getting away from the chicken nugget model, which is you've got to ask yourself the right questions. Do I feel seen? Do I feel heard? But the most important issue is, do I feel safe? Do I feel I can bring my authentic self into this space? Whatever that feels like. And that, those are questions people don't typically grapple with is, do I feel performative? Or after the first 20 minutes or hour where we all feel performative, is there a you that's starting to come out? And unfortunately, most people haven't done the work on the you, but I very much focus on this sense of safety. I don't think a lot of people, to us, safety is anyone about to mug me as I walk to my car? And I'm like, I'm not talking about that kind of safety. Safety is you're fully in your skin, that you're showing up as you and it's going to be okay. That's an example of sort of higher order discernment, but it's also, you know, it's, how is a person attending to you? How are they managing stress? And listen, we all have stuff. We really do all have stuff. What I might discern away because it doesn't work for me, someone else may be very drawn to. I remember a friend, she cared deeply that somebody knew, she's very chic, and she cared deeply that somebody knew about fashion and was able to recognize that her shoes were very nice and her bag was very nice. If I was with somebody who cared about that, I would discern them out. I wouldn't want to be with someone like that. That's I don't like that stuff. It feels elitist. It feels snobby. That's my experience of it. It worked great for her. And that was, so my point is discernment. There's some universality. Can I show up as my true self? But fashion girl was going to be able to show up as fashion girl with fashion guy. Me and my sort of, I don't know, like my target clothes, fashion guy would have probably left before we got the drink. So I would be able to sense that. It's to trust that. And I think that the problem, Eli, is that a lot of people are testing out these discernment skills for the very first time when they're actually in relationships. And the step zero, if you will, is that you're actually doing the discovery of self. Who am I? What do I stand for? What am I about? What are my values? Where do I feel safe? Who am I? We do not do this work with people. This should be the entire curriculum from K through 12. So by the end of 12th grade, people are like, you know, I'm actually very introverted. I'm very empathic, maybe to a fault. So people might be able to take advantage of that. I'm not so sure that I want a traditional marriage. Can you imagine kids having those conversations? It would you and I be out of a job.
I was just going to say that we're going to be out of a That's job. Fine. That's totally literally, fine. Literally majority of the people that I'm working with when it comes to either individuals within their relationships or couples is this newfound aha moments of yes. discernment, realizing that things don't work as they thought or locking themselves in
Correct.
Because something worked in the, and then whatever reasoning that they struggle mm-hmm. with that level of discernment. But to me, and maybe this is something that I grew up learning, I'm Orthodox Jewish and I grew up in with my family, you know, teaching me this thing of being aware of how I feel and comfort and safety within a relationship. And I asked those questions when I was dating. Like we talked through things, and I even had a mentor who did something like an import-export list, is something that I push a lot with my clients, is the concept of what worked in your family that you want to bring in, and let's talk mm-hmm. about it. What didn't work in your family that you don't want to have happen in our relationship, and how we as a unit figure out what we like, mm-hmm. we as a unit and individual together, mm-hmm. right? And I think that that idea, okay, checklist's nice. Checklist is really important for certain things. You know, a jokey thing that I say often with friends, I don't usually use this as much with my clients, but with friends who would ask me questions as, you know, oh, you're a therapist, kind of, do you feel comfortable sitting in your pajamas next to this person, farting, being yourself, burping, yes. just being you in all your glory and no one making you feel unsafe? You right. can joke, you can make fun in a kind way, not a malicious way. And everyone walks away feeling, I can be me. I can be silly. Right. I can be real. I can be honest without judgment or used against me and things of that nature. If the answer is, yeah, I can see myself with this person feeling as comfortable as possible, that's amazing. That's correct. Wonderful.
Correct. Correct. There's a challenge here, though, because I think there are many people, again, step zero, who have never felt safe.
Yeah.
There was no pajama fart place because yeah. everything in their lives, forget even judgment, it was harm, mm-hmm. right? And so because so many people have histories of adversity and trauma and invalidation from childhood, safety yeah. doesn't exist. Mm. So it goes beyond what can it be with another person. There's not even safety in one's Himself. Body. There's not even safety in the self. And so that's why I'm saying is that step zero is how do we even start having that experience of safety in self? And that yeah. is, you know, and obviously there's a whole spectrum and continuum of experience there. People who might have complex trauma, who had very, very trying, painful childhoods, they're coming at this from a very, very different place. And I have seen this in a lot of survivors of narcissistic relationships who will say, what I came from was brutal. What I mm-hmm. ended up in was brutal. And the idea of discernment was laughable because even making a fundamental need known was going to result in shame and acrimony and criticism. That's often the setup, but not mm-hmm. always. I mean, very mm-hmm. happy people come from happy homes and healthy homes like you did could also be vulnerable to this. Mm-hmm. But I think that a lot more people have come from pretty tough beginnings. And so that work of self, it almost feels self-indulgent. It feels mm-hmm. selfish. And it would be shamed by that yeah. system, by that family of origin.
You know, I have two last questions and I want to make sure we have time to talk about your book coming out. You know, is that something where someone comes from chaos to go to chaos because of comfort or what they know or what they know how to deal with, or it just happens to be that they fall into that relationship with someone?
I think coming from chaos disrupts the discernment process. It normalizes it, right? What I try to get away from is this idea of chaos seeks chaos.
Yeah.
I think that there's a complicity we can foster in survivors if we take that. You were just looking for someone who is reproducing. I don't think that that's what anybody is doing. Mm-hmm. Unconsciously, there might be more of a compelling draw. We talk about trauma bonding and all of this other stuff. But I think that discernment goes away because self-valuation goes away. If I don't value myself, I'm certainly not going to discern who I let into my life because I don't think that I deserve that much. And so mm-hmm. I think that it's almost all self-care goes when there's early adversity. People might use substances. They may eat poorly. They may not engage in healthy self-care behaviors. They may not push for aspirations that matter, and they're not going to choose healthy people. Discernment's discernment. Mm-hmm. It cuts across multiple areas of life. But mm-hmm. I think that chaos takes away the capacity for discernment. And if a person's been through trauma, especially denied trauma, then they're thinking like, I don't even know what reality is. Who am I to even say anything? There's a complete loss of trust in self. And that becomes rather, again, that's where trauma therapy becomes such an essential piece of the model. Trauma-informed work, real trauma-informed work, not in name only, but the real deal before a person really starts throwing their hat into the relationship ring.
So what are some of like maybe 2 to 3 basic skills that we can teach our children? Mm-hmm. Like you said, from K to, 12. So I'm a parent. I got a 4.5-year-old, You know, like where does that and a 23-month-old and a new puppy, hooray me. I love it. But what are some of the things that we can start doing with our children as parents to be more cognizant of creating that discernment or mm-hmm. understanding of sense of trust mm-hmm. and all that kind of wonderful things that we're trying to create for people?
Don't put your kids on an agenda. So if your child, let me give you an example. Let's say there's a cousin that comes over. They're like, I don't like to play with Mary. Instead of like, you're going to play with Mary. It's what's going on? What's going on? Like, Mary just takes all the toys. She bosses the playtime. First of all, acknowledge that our tendency is like, you're going to play with everyone in the sandbox. No, you're not. Mm-hmm. 5-year-olds don't like each other. 55-year-olds don't like, everyone. We like what we like. We don't like what we don't like. Allow your child to have those moments. They don't get to ever be mean to Mary, but that might be a wake up to you say, okay, well, what might Mary is coming over because her mom and dad are coming. What could we do to make this day better, for you with Mary? And mm-hmm. it might be the kind of thing where you might say, well, set up an activity for them that's more monitored. Or something like that. Now your child feels heard. They made something known. Something wasn't forced on them. And in a sort of modification that wasn't crazy, but, sort of appropriate to the situation. Maybe there's a sort of a game set up where Mary can't be sort of terrorizing the toy table and it becomes more of a balance. That child would have then felt seen, heard, and safe. That happens several, many times. That child's going to feel like, I can communicate something appropriately and that the adults around me would be responsive. One of the most cataclysmic things that can happen to a child is when the child has the courage to share something and the adults are non-responsive. That's its own form of trauma. So to be responsive to children and to work on real solutions and allow them to share their feelings is a big one. I would say that's number one.
Thank you so much for adding that piece. Thank you so much for saying that piece. That's so important for people to hear. I'm so glad you said that. Yeah. What else?
Another one I would say is, it's funny. When my kids were young, I would have them, I'd say to my daughter, it's, her name, and it was, whatever, my daughter's name, me day. Like it was her, she got to pick everything that day, like be birthday, special occasion. And from front to back of that day, but she had to explain the why. So first thing we're going to do is we're going to make this thing for breakfast. Sure. Let's mess up the kitchen, honey. Why this? And she'd say, because this takes such a long time. And that means we all have to talk to each other. Ding. So that to me is like, okay, we do need to slow down and spend more time with each other, right? And then it was like, I think one time we ended up at like Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum, heaven help me. And I thought, why this? And she said, because her sister, she said, because she'd never have done this. And she would always made fun with me for doing it. And I saw it so many times and I wanted to see it. And I knew it was my day, so she couldn't make fun of me. So shaming from her sibling was an issue. So we were able to work on that. There's moments you can create with your children where, because our children are so overscheduled and all that, have that day where it's not just they get to pick what it is, but then they have to put the intention behind it. It helps them explore motivation. One of the reasons narcissistic relationships are so tough is narcissistic people have no realistic insight into their motivation for doing things. And in some ways, a lot of us as adults, if you really say, why do you do what you do? A lot of us are like, let me get back to you on that. For a child, for us to be able to say, oh, I do this because I want to do this because that you're allowing a child to dig into their motivations, which to me is a skill most adults don't have. And it puts value to the thing they're asking for is important. And it's necessary. And I think it's a fun thing. We used to do this on their birthdays. It was always a birthday thing. And we'd throw it into some other time of year. They're asked, now they're 20 and 23. So they're like, when are we doing me day again? I'm like, oh my God, this is going to be spa. It's going to be real expensive. Like, I have to go to the spa and I have to get my hair done. We have to go shopping. I'm like, well, maybe we'll do a 3-hour me day. I also do think we need to teach our children to lose. One thing I tell everyone is if you've got a child and you're playing a board game, Chutes and Ladders is a great example because Chutes and Ladders is like a casino. It's all, there's no game in that system, right? A parent's not going to be no smarter at it, right? And sometimes they're going to lose Chutes and Ladders. And I remember once playing with my child, she lost it. You know, I got that last big ladder and I was on my way. And she said, that's unfair. And I said, oh, slow down. I'm so happy I won and I'm enjoying this. And this hurts because, you know, and we had to really talk about how if you're the parent, you no. And so that there's these moments of regulation that we would have upon losing the game. I think a lot of parents want to capitulate so their kid always feels great. And then they're touching into uncomfortable feelings in a safe space. But all of this requires parental presence.
I love that.
So and I important. Failed at all of this, by the way. I mean, my daughter and I, was 20, were playing a game the other day, and she got really mad that I beat her. And I'm like, what? And she said, no. Redo. We have to do this again. So, I mean, the lessons only go so far.
you have a new book coming out.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about it a little bit so people can pre-order? Get their hands on it.
Please pre-order this book. It's called It's Not You, and Identifying and Understanding Narcissistic People. So many of the books about narcissistic relationships are almost solely about the narcissist. Not enough of it is about how we heal and take ourselves back. The other problem with a lot of books about narcissism is they're almost entirely predicated on you have to get out of this relationship. And that's an option that's not available to many people. Or people don't, it may not be an intimate relationship. Maybe a parent and they're like, I can't, I mean, there's no way I'm going to not talk to my parents anymore, but can learn to talk differently and have realistic expectations of what that can be. There's a lot of grief and these relationships change us. Doesn't mean we're forever damaged, but nothing like that. But it does mean that the way we go through the world changes. And instead of pathologizing that, to receive that with grace and self-compassion, this is really a book about narcissism for the survivors instead of just one more book doing the sort of the dissection of what this personality is about.
Mm. So exciting. I can't wait to,
thank you,
to get my hands on it. I read your other books and such an honor to talk to you today. I know you've done unbelievable work and hopefully continues for so many people. Bring knowledge and expertise to words that are used wrong or inappropriately to create real education and real knowledge on things that impact real people on a daily basis.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, Leigh. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Hey, thanks so much for listening to this week's episode of Dude Therapist Season 5. Can you believe it? I can't. What a journey. Thanks so much for tuning in. Whether it's your first episode you've listened to, or you've been a follower since the beginning, or just trying to catch up, I appreciate you. Thanks so much for really jumping in on this awesome opportunity and learning experience. You know, if you have any questions, ask them. You have thoughts, say them. I didn't finish a thought, or you have more ideas of what you would like to hear, just let me know. The door is open, so to speak. So please walk right in. Tell me what you think. Again, thanks so much for tuning into this week's episode of The Dude Therapist, and hope that you tune in next week.